For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. troops on the ground in Libya. The U.S. Defense Department acknowledged Wednesday that U.S. military forces are on the ground in Libya looking for potential partners in what could soon be an expanded campaign against Islamic State. Peter Cook is a Pentagon spokesman.
We are extremely worried about the metastasis of ISIL to other locations, Libya being just one of those locations. We continue to monitor the situation there, continue to work very closely with our coalition partners, with others in the region who have similar concerns about the situation in Libya. And I think it's fair to say that we're closely monitoring the situation, as Chairman Dunford has indicated, working with those partners and also continuing to have conversations with people on the ground as to exactly what's happening there and the threat that ISIL poses to the United States and others.
Cook described the U.S. contingent as small, adding they were in Libya at the concurrence of Libyan officials. While not the biggest force in Libya, IS has been growing stronger in recent months, cementing its hold on the city of Sirte and surrounding areas. A U.S. official familiar with the intelligence recently told VOA about 500 key IS officials and fighters who left Syria and Iraq during the past several weeks of last year moved to Libya in what appeared to be a calculated move. Western officials estimate IS may now have as many as 5,000 fighters in Libya. Suicide bombers Wednesday killed at least 12 and wounded 30 others in Chibok, the northern Nigerian town where Boko Haram kidnapped hundreds of schoolgirls nearly 2 years ago. Witnesses say a bomber detonated explosives at a checkpoint where people were being searched. At least two others blew themselves up in the town's market. There's no immediate claim of responsibility, but the attack bore the hallmarks of Boko Haram, which often targets public gathering spots. This is VOA News. The United States is urging all parties invited to this week's Syrian peace talks in Geneva to show up without precondition. It follows the dispatch of invitations Tuesday by UN Special Envoy Staffan de Mistura to various opposition groups ahead of the scheduled Friday launch of the latest international effort to achieve a political transition in Syria. Mark Toner is a U.S. State Department spokesman.
We've encouraged the Syrian opposition's High Negotiations Committee to respond positively to Special Envoy de Mistura's invitation. As you know, Secretary Kerry met last week weekend in Riyadh with the HNC to express our focus on the need for a political transition, a ceasefire, and a need to implement confidence-building measures, including immediate humanitarian access to many of these hard-to-reach areas in Syria.
The talks on a ceasefire and setting up a transitional government are to get underway in Geneva. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta Wednesday led a memorial service for the soldiers killed while on peacekeeping duty in Somalia. Al-Shabaab Islamist militants claim to have killed 100 soldiers in a January 15 attack on an army base in southern Somalia. Mr. Kenyatta vowed to keep the country's commitment as part of the African Union force fighting the militants in Somalia.
This is not the time to waver or to listen to the voices of defeat and despair. This is the time for the people and the government of Somalia to choose peace and progress over violence, hatred, and stagnation.
The service was also attended by Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed and Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani is in France, the first official visit of an Iranian leader there since 1999. He flew in from Italy, where he closed business deals worth $18.5 billion. The visits come after the sanctions were lifted from the Islamic Republic as part of a nuclear agreement. The International Criminal Court prosecutor is vowing to leave no stone unturned as the trial of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo, who faces charges of crimes against humanity, gets underway Thursday. Fatou Bensouda spoke Wednesday. Gbagbo faces charges related to post-2010 election violence that left some 3,000 dead. He refused to give up his post even after being defeated by the incumbent, Alassane Ouattara. Asian markets are little changed in Thursday trading, but oil, which gained Wednesday, was lower in Asia trading between $32 and $33 a barrel. U.S. stocks fell Wednesday after the U.S. Central Bank, known as the Federal Reserve, announced it would not raise a key interest rate. Fed statement said the stock markets have been too turbulent across the world. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Amnesty International calls for a fair trial as former President Laurent Gbagbo's ICC trial begins today, Thursday.
The opening of the trial of Laurent Gbagbo is a historic event for international justice. It's, of course, also a very grand day for the victims of the conflict in Côte d'Ivoire.
Stephen Colburn is Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa. Senegal's security is on edge as fear of terrorism grows. Candidates complain over annulment of Central African Republic's election results. And Zambia's Catholic bishops warn against violence ahead of August election.
The Catholic bishops in Zambia categorically indicate that they are not pleased with the way the police sometimes conduct itself. They have called on the police to be objective, to be nonpartisan, and for a police to be professional.
Father Cleophas Longo is the General Secretary of the Zambia Episcopal Conference. Sierra Leone firefighters deal with lack of equipment and water, and the international community is urged not to tie humanitarian aid to Libya's political process. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The long-awaited trial of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo gets underway today, Thursday, at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, in The Hague. Gbagbo, who is 70, and his close ally and former militia leader Charles Blaye Goudé are charged with crimes against humanity, including murder, rape, and persecution stemming from Ivory Coast post-election conflict in 2010 and 2011. It is estimated that more than 1,000 people were killed. Stephen Colburn is Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa. He says the trial marks a milestone in the search for justice for the victims of the crimes allegedly committed during the crisis.
The opening of the trial of Laurent Gbagbo is a historic event for international justice. It's the first time that a former head of state will be tried in front of the court. It's, of course, also a very grand day for the victims of the conflict in Côte d'Ivoire, which have, of course, had thousands of victims, first of all from the conflict in 2002-3, then again in 2010 and 2011. And so it's extremely important for justice and reconciliation that this trial can be done successfully. The other thing that we're trying to mark on this day is to also be clear that justice has to be even-handed in Ivory Coast. So while it's a positive step that Gbagbo and his former Minister of Youth, Charles Blaye Goudé, are being tried, it's important that national and international courts look at the suspected perpetrators of violence and other crimes under international law of the President Ouattara side as well, to make sure that justice is even-handed and fair.
That has been the argument of Gbagbo's supporters, that perhaps the international community has been one-sided, that they think the trial of President Gbagbo is political, because they say that not only Gbagbo supporters might have committed crimes, they also think that current President Alassane Ouattara supporters also committed crimes. And you are saying that justice should be even-handed.
Justice should absolutely be even-handed. Those who are suspected of having committed serious human rights violations or crimes under international law should be investigated, and if there's enough evidence, prosecuted, no matter their background or their political affiliation. So we do have some very high-profile cases at an international level focusing on Gbagbo and his former Minister of Youth. We also have a number of trials and arrests within Côte d'Ivoire itself. Unfortunately, it is true that there's been far more investigations and arrests on the side of Gbagbo than the side of Ouattara, and that's something that the authorities in Côte d'Ivoire as well as international courts should look at to make sure that it is evenly done. It's, of course, extremely important that Laurent Gbagbo has a fair trial. It's important that he has the right to a good defense. It's important that his side is clearly represented and that has the ability to challenge evidence and challenge the charges against them.
Stephen Colburn is Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa. He was speaking with me from Senegal's capital, Dakar. State security officers these days line the streets of many of Dakar's main thoroughfares with guns slung over their shoulders. The increased security comes after France is said to have warned Senegal and Ivory Coast that Islamist militants are planning to attack the country's main cities. Over the past weekend, checkpoints were set up and 900 people were ticketed or arrested in Senegal, although none of those infractions were terrorism-related. William Asambo is a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. He tells Ricky Stryak that the government is hoping to prevent an event similar to the recent attack in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, where Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb militant stormed a hotel and cafe and killed 30 people.
Over the recent days, we witnessed the security measures that were improved in the city of Dakar. Security people, military and police officers posted at run about and posted in some places, some key places, supermarkets, also some hotels. And I think it's clearly an indication that national authorities in Senegal are aware of the fact that following the attack in Ouagadougou, Senegal is not safe from a terrorist threat. And I think it's also following some warning that were reportedly issued by France or the U.S. So I think clearly it's an indication that Senegal is concerned about the threat posed by the terrorists.
Do they have tangible information about an imminent threat?
I won't be in a position to tell you what kind of intelligence they receive from France or the U.S. If we take into account what the response and the measure that were taken, we can assume that they receive some serious warning.
Over the weekend, they ticketed or arrested 900 people, but none of these were really terrorism related. A lot of them were traffic violations, insurance, ID violations, or there were some drug arrests. Is there any concern that with this increase in security, there might be some people who are arrested unlawfully?
Yes, so far I haven't any indication that could say that there was some violation of human rights resulting in the arrest we recorded over the recent days. I think it was a public relation. That operation was mainly a public operation. And when we look at the result of the operation by the arrest of 900 people in no related to terrorism issue is clearly an indication that it has not been really effective in addressing the terrorist threat. So,
yeah, I guess that's the other concern, is how effective is this clampdown if they haven't arrested anyone in relation to planning a terrorist event?
Yes, so far, really, this operation has not proven effective in preventing any terrorist threat. I mean, based on the information we got following a communique that was issued by the Senegalese security forces. But, you know, usually they are not telling all the truth, so we don't know if there were something that were...
Has the government said how long they plan on having this increased security?
No, we don't know for how long these measures are going to be there. And usually, a security issue, they usually don't tell how long the security measures are going to be in place.
William Asambo is a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Fighting fires is always a challenge, and the people who do it risk their lives all the time. In Sierra Leone, the challenges are even greater due to a lack of equipment and often a lack of water. Nina DeVries has more from Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown.
Abdullahi Ibrahim Karoma suffered a head injury while fighting a fire over the Christmas holiday. Karoma says he ended up paying for some of his treatment because Sierra Leone firefighters have minimal insurance coverage.
Those medication they give us now, it's just a first aid treatment. They are not for us to recover our health unless we use out of our own money.
His story is typical among Sierra Leone's firefighting corps. Firefighters also lack basic gear such as breathing equipment, and there are limited helmets and boots. Alhaji Sako is an American firefighter originally from Sierra Leone. Sako, who visited a fire station in his homeland last month, donated more than $50,000 worth of gear, including helmets and coats. He says more is needed to help his fellow firefighters.
It's passion. It's passion. I have to do something. You know, at heart, that's what I want to do. I want to give back to home.
The capital, Freetown, has only two operating fire hydrants, and neither of them is near the fire station, says the deputy chief, Sylvester Mataluva. He says it can take more than 30 minutes to get to a hydrant in heavy traffic. He says when they get to the hydrant, there's another concern.
We have problem with water for fighting fire. Normally, not all the hydrants have water.
The entire country has struggled with a water shortage for decades. The Guma Dam, the main source of water in Freetown, was built decades ago when the city only had a population of a few thousand people. Today, the city has a population of 1.2 million, and demand has far outstripped the water supply. The government says it's trying to address the issue firefighters are facing. Joseph Bandabla Dauda is Sierra Leone's Minister of Internal Affairs. He says five new fire trucks will be coming soon from China. Others were recently donated from Germany. Dauda says firefighters are now being asked to let the water companies know when there is a fire.
As and when they are promptly informed about an area where fire incidents has occurred, then they can divert the water supply to that area and make the hydrant there operational.
The hydrant would be closed again once the fire is out. He adds water companies also have bowsers, big mobile water tanks that they can bring to fires until a better solution is found. As for insurance, Dauda also admits that needs to be improved, but says the government has not received any complaints about firefighters paying their own bills from the recent fires and injuries. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Bate, Washington. Today's Thursday, January 28th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 and a half minutes past the hour. The Catholic Bishops' Conference in Zambia has warned citizens not to take the country's peace for granted. In a letter issued on the State of the Nation 2016, the bishops expressed concern about violence amongst supporters of political parties in the run-up to the August 11 general election. Father Cleopas Longu is General Secretary of the conference. He tells reporter Peter Clotty that the bishops want to make sure that politicians and their supporters do not disturb Zambia's peace, especially as the parties prepare to launch their campaigns for the coming general elections.
These concerns are based on the fact that they have noted with deep concern the vulgar language which is used by our politicians, one against each other. Also some pockets of violence as we experienced in the recent past. So their concern is that Zambia has been a haven of peace, an oasis of peace, if you like, for decades past. But we need not to take peace for granted. It is a gift from God, yes, we believe, but also a responsibility of all citizens, but more so a responsibility that shoulders upon our leaders.
Some have expressed concern that the police that have been mandated by the Constitution to enforce law and order seem to have become partisan, and that is why some of these party supporters are taking the law into their own hands and being vengeful and attacking each other. What is your reaction to some of these concerns expressed by some of these Zambian citizens themselves?
The Catholic bishops in Zambia did categorically indicate that they are not pleased with the way the police sometimes conduct itself. They have called on the police to be objective, to be non-partisan, and for a police to be professional. More often than not, the bishops have said the police do tend to favor the politicians in the ruling party, and the opposition parties are not guaranteed their well-deserved freedom of association and of peaceful demonstration or peaceful political activities. In the run-up to the upcoming elections, the bishops have appealed to the president, have appealed to the government, have also appealed to the police service itself to take seize of their opportunity to demonstrate once more that they can rise above partisan politics.
Father Cleopas Longu is the General Secretary of the Zambia Episcopal Conference. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. In the Central African Republic, the results of the parliamentary elections held on December 30th have been annulled and candidates have to run again. The Constitutional Court on Monday upheld the results of the first round of the presidential election but ruled that there were too many irregularities in the parliamentary poll. Nick Long reports from the capital, Bangui, where the prime minister explained on Wednesday that the biggest irregularity in the poll was the lack of ballot papers.
CAR's Prime Minister Mahamat Kamoun said in a media interview Wednesday that the country's polling stations were short of 500,000 ballot papers for the parliamentary elections on December the 30th. Kamoun was defending the Constitutional Court's decision to invalidate the results of those elections, a decision that's not gone down well with candidates who thought they had won. Former government minister Ambroise Zawa was one of those candidates. In my constituency, he says, we had ballot papers. I won with 82% of the votes, and I deeply regret that the court has rejected the results and is telling us to stand again. Who is going to pay our bill, he asks, when we're already elected? Zawa also says it's unfair that the first round of presidential elections was not cancelled, as there were many complaints about them as well. Journalist and commentator Eric Bondo rejects Zawa's claim that the court's decisions were inconsistent.
Le président a bien précisé que toutes les plaintes que leur greffe a enregistrées.
He says the court was very clear that as regards the presidential election, there was no proof shown of irregularities at particular polling stations, whereas in the parliamentary elections there was proof. For example, he says there was no parliamentary vote at his local polling station. A spokesman for the National Electoral Authority, Julius Nguade Baba, told VOA the ballot papers had been printed at the last moment and there was no time to ensure they reached all the polling stations. Why the last-minute rush?
Puisque nous voulons organiser des élections qui soient inclusives. Nous avons fait preuve de beaucoup de...
Nguade Baba says it's because they wanted to organise inclusive elections, so they were very tolerant with the 1,000 or so candidates who did not submit their candidatures on time. He said the time for submitting applications for the parliamentary elections is now over. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
A senior Libyan official is appealing to the international community not to tie humanitarian aid to his country's political process. He says the health needs of the Libyan people cannot wait until a government of national unity is formed. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Libya has been in a perpetual state of war since its people took up arms in 2011 to oust dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Libya's health minister, Reda El Oakley, warns his country's health system is near collapse. He says up to 70% of the hospitals are shut down or dysfunctional. He says 80% of Libya's highly skilled medical staff was composed of foreign expatriates who left the country. He says the economy is in shambles because Libya is exporting very little oil, once its main money earner. He says people are unable to obtain the health services they desperately need because of the lack of money. He says the international community is reluctant to provide humanitarian aid to Libya because the country's two competing administrations cannot agree on a government of national unity. He tells VOA this linkage is hurting Libya's health system and the poor patients who cannot receive treatment for their illnesses.
I think the international community, including UN, should divorce humanitarian need of Libyan people away from any political dialogue. Anything short of that, I would consider it to be a crime. Similar happening in Syria today, where people dying of hunger simply awaiting a conclusion of political dialogue.
The World Health Organization reports nearly half of Libya's population of 6.3 million is vulnerable and in need of humanitarian assistance. Of this number, it says 1.9 million are in need of health services. The WHO representative in Libya, Jafar Hussein, says most of these people are unable to get even the most basic primary health care. He says the international community cannot afford to ignore their difficult circumstances.
Complacency would lead to much more serious consequences, and we will end up with massive outbreaks. We will end up with mortality and morbidity rates rise exponentially, and we will end up compromising the health and the future of the people of Libya if we don't act now.
WHO reports Libya is at increased risk of communicable diseases, including tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV/AIDS, as a result of large numbers of migrants, many from sub-Saharan Africa, and a collapsed surveillance system. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Zimbabwe man has filed a case in the country's constitutional court challenging the legality of life imprisonment. Thomas Chiripasi has details from Harare.
The Constitutional Court of Appeal heard an application filed by Obadiah Makoni, who was convicted for murder and sentenced to life imprisonment in 1995, and now wants his sentence to be declared unconstitutional. In his application, Makoni's attorney, Tendai Biti, told the court that sentencing a person to life in jail violates the United Nations Convention Against Torture, Inhuman and Degrading Treatment, as well as some sections of Zimbabwe's constitution.
The law was amended in 2007 to say life means life. So if you're sentenced to life, you can rot in prison for the whole of your life. So the argument there was that it becomes disproportionate, it becomes cruel. And therefore, in breach of the Section 53 of the Constitution and Section 51 of the Constitution, and that we must follow international standards.
It is said the Zimbabwean legal system did not provide for an independent review mechanism for those who would have been sentenced to life imprisonment, unlike in other countries where there is a judicial review of a prisoner's case after 15 years. But prosecutor Mike Chimombe opposed the application, saying Zimbabwean law does not have a provision to review life sentences. He said the constitutional provision for a presidential pardon was enough to cater for such review under the circumstances. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Zambia and Mali play to a scoreless draw at the Orange African Nations Championships in the Nyamirambo Stadium in Kigali, Rwanda on Wednesday, while Uganda came from behind to hold Zimbabwe to a 1-1 draw at the Umganda Stadium in Gishenyi, some 160 kilometers northwest of the capital, Kigali. Consequently, Zambia and Mali joined Cameroon, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Tunisia and Rwanda in the quarterfinals. In Egypt, visitors Jordan pipped Egypt by a solitary goal in a friendly match played in Aswan, some 850 kilometers south of the Egyptian capital Cairo on Wednesday. Egypt hosts Libya in another friendly match at the same venue tomorrow, Friday. In Algeria, winger Riyad Mahrez is the 2015 Golden Ball Award winner. Mahrez was voted Algeria's best football player by the country's Premier League team captains, coaches and club presidents, the national team coach and captain, along with the Algerian media. Other awards were presented to the Algerian team that won the gold medal at the World Military Games in South Korea, the Algerian team that has qualified for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics, and USM Algiers, who were runners-up at the 2015 Orange Africa Champions League. A special honorary award was bestowed on retired Egyptian icon Mohamed Abu Trika for his contribution to African football. Turning to handball, hosts Egypt dismissed the Republic of Congo 40-18 in quarterfinal action at the African Men's Handball Championships in Cairo on Wednesday. In other matches, Angola pipped Morocco 22-21. Defending champions Algeria overcame the Democratic Republic of Congo 34-25, and Tunisia outplayed Cameroon 24-20. In classification matches, Nigeria beat Kenya 32-23 as Libya edged Gabon 29-26. Finally, the Africa Archery Championships starts in Windhoek, Namibia today, Thursday. Over 100 competitors vying for glory have come from Algeria, Benin, Ivory Coast, Kenya, Libya, Malawi, Mauritius, Morocco, South Africa, Sudan, Tunisia, Zimbabwe, and Namibia. The four-day event is a qualifier for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil and the 2017 World Archery Championships in Warsaw, Poland. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Thursday, January 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good Thursday.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting Monday, February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, select the number 25 to leave us your answer. Get up.